Welcome, welcome, welcome to this special edition of Studio 2 from WHYY in Philadelphia, the city which birthed American independence. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, we have spent a lot of time covering the American Revolution's local history in the lead up to the nation's 250th birthday. Would you say we are officially experts on the revolution now?
I would say yay.
Yay, not
as
nay.
In yes.
Yay over nay.
Yay, exactly.
You know, I'm going to take it because we did put our work in, we put our miles in, and it was a lot of interesting conversation. And I really do have to thank a lot of the people who turned out for those conversations because y'all made it special.
And we all learned together. We did so much coverage and we still have more. So today we're broadcasting a bit of our Tavern Revolution 250 series and replaying a fantastic interview about a new film that closely follows the lives of enslaved Africans and diverse communities during the fight for independence.
Later in the hour, we're taking it on the road to Chad's Ford to talk about the Battle of Brandywine, a defeat for the colonists, but somehow a victory for George Washington's army. But first, Cherry, it is still lunchtime, right?
Oh, yeah. Are you talking about Yards Brewing?
I am talking about Yards Brewing Company. You know, we went to Yards, located in Philly, to talk about the food and drink of the Revolution and a bunch of the little-known history behind it.
At this Tavern Revolution event, we sat down with Tom Kehoe. You could call him the founding father of Yards Brewing. He's been a fixture of the Philly beer scene for over a decade and the co-creator of a series of brews called Ales of the Revolution.
We also peppered Tegan Schweitzer with our food and drink questions. She's a food anthropologist, historical archaeologist, and chef. We asked Tegan to set the table for our conversation by explaining just how different grocery shopping and cooking looked in 1776.
Not that differently in a lot of respects from what we eat today, in that the available meats in the marketplace would have been the same ones that we tend to see: beef, pork, mutton, duck, goose, turkey, all varieties of available fish in the area. We all know that New Jersey is the Garden State. A lot of produce came across the Delaware River to the markets in Philadelphia, and people would go there. Of course, those markets were right along Market Street, and people would come to buy from those vendors on a daily basis. That was not the only market in Philadelphia, but it was the biggest one and the most prominent. In colonial period, there was not as much of a distinction between sweet and savory parts of the meal, so they were more interchangeable and interwoven instead of more of the savory and then the sweeter things at the end of the meal. In terms of what people were eating, a lot of soups and stews, but there were also very high-end foods with delicate presentations. It kind of depended where in the social spectrum you landed, how much money you had to spend, who you were trying to show off to. But these are all foods that we would recognize and enjoy today.
So I'm guessing the soups and stews were if you didn't have as much money. Like that would be your sort of typical meal.
Yes, and those would also be available in tavern-type context or group dining experiences. But, of course, my favorite kind of soup is turtle soup.
Let's talk about turtle soup.
Yeah, tell us about
that. A bit of a lost art, although people might know about it. So first, describe turtle soup and describe who was making and eating turtle soup.
Okay, well, it's kind of a thicker, unctuous type of soup. And of course, in Philadelphia, we have our particular style of turtle soup that varies from other cities up and down the eastern seaboard. Here in Philadelphia, we pour sherry over the soup before we eat it. So obviously, it's the best way. Traditionally, in the early 18th century, turtle soup would be made out of sea turtles. And those were coming from the Caribbean trade. They could weigh up to 500 pounds and they would be sold at the waterfront in an auction type scenario. So typically a tavern or a wealthy household would, or even they had turtle soup houses, would purchase the turtle and then turn it into soup. And soup was only one of the dishes that you could make out of a turtle. There were up to seven using different parts of the turtle. And if you're a very wealthy person, you would have a whole meal that was just that turtle and how you were presenting different body parts on different parts of the table. And you would, of course, have your soup tureen that was shaped like a turtle that you would serve it out of, or you could use the turtle shell to serve it out of, as that's part of your tureen.
This is very top chef. This is impressive.
I know.
Oh, yeah. And And then you could purchase them in smaller quantities to be consumed at the household level if you wanted to. After they ran out of sea turtles, diamondback terrapin became the more popular turtle. It was available locally, had a soft, nice texture. And then, of course, snapping turtle, which is what anyone who's eating turtle soup today, most likely you're eating a snapping turtle type of soup. It's just always been part of the Philadelphia tradition, and let's keep it going.
Yeah.
It's a great food.
Wow.
All right.
Another type of some dishes that I understand were very common then was pepper pot soup.
Mm-hmm.
Scrapple also was pretty big. And
yeah.
ice cream. Things
yes.
That I didn't know. I was like, okay, yeah, I know ice cream had a very, you know, storied history here in Philadelphia. But those were three interesting dishes.
Exactly.
Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so pepper pot soup is a great example of the African-American influence on the cuisine in Philadelphia, which, if you're not aware, African-American influence was huge in this city. For example, caterers across Philadelphia tended to be Black people. And so if you wanted your event catered, they had wonderful catered events, and they were just the top of the society in terms of that career. For pepper pot soup, it's one of the foods that would be sold on the street. So women would walk around and they would bang their soup tureen and they would yell, pepper pot, piping hot. And so if you wanted to come and get some soup, you'd come out with your own individual bowl. So you bring your ceramic from your house and then you'd be like, I'd like some soup. Then they would serve it up to you.
And Tom, we want to bring you into the conversation
sure.
because now that we kind of have a better understanding and we'll dig more into who was eating what and all of that with you, Tegan, but I know you are a beer man, beer master.
Yes.
Who actually got really obsessed with historical beer. So tell us a little bit about how you kind of hooked on to the idea of Ales of the Revolution.
Well, we were approached by the City Tavern, and I guess in their lease they were supposed to have things that were made during the time or around the time of the American Revolution. And they came to us and we're just like, yeah, we would love to do stuff like this. Started researching and, you know, came up with two of the beers right away. And the third one came because that was the Ben Franklin or the Poor Richard Spruce, because it was his Ben Franklin's tercentenary, I guess, in 2005. So it was his 300th birthday.
300th birthday.
So.
All right. So, yeah, there's these three beers that are inspired by recipes
yes.
from the colonial era. So let's just pick one. Tell us who was inspired by it and, like, what's in it. And
yeah.
was it hard to source? Because, you know, I would imagine some of this stuff is not used very commonly in beer making anymore.
Well, it is, which is
it
the
is.
Great thing about beer.
Okay.
Yeah, because
it's timeless.
Beer is basically grain, which is the malted barley. It is hops, yeast, and water. That's what makes up beer. Basically, we had all the right ingredients. The brewers back then had older technology, but they still sort of knew, you know, they knew how to brew because nobody had newer technology back then. So we just have a little bit of easier time measuring and getting temperatures and pH and things like that. So,
and what was so fascinating about, you know, looking into beer and history was people drank a lot of beer.
Yes.
During the years around the Revolution. And I want you to, Tom, just help us understand how much beer were folks drinking.
Yeah. I mean, there was no Coke or Pepsi.
No competition.
Or
nice.
Anything like that. But yeah, beer was something that came from, you know, English, German, which were all in this area. And it was safe to drink. Nobody was going to get sick from beer. You know, they would do something called party guile, which they would get two different beers out of one brew. They would take the strong runnings off the beginning of the lager tun, boil that, and then they would have the secondary runnings, which they made a small beer out of, which would be a lot weaker, but it would still be prepped the same way, boiled, and some hops added to it and things like that. And hops were really added to balance the sweetness of the beer. It gives it bitterness. It gives it balance. If you put a lot of hops in, it makes it more bitter. But, you know, that bitterness really gives it a little balance from just having a really sweet, sweet beverage.
And it's not just the beer, right, Tegan? It's where people are drinking the beer and what they're doing when they're drinking the beer. And I also understand that in addition to there being lots of taverns, there were lots of coffee houses around that time. So people were getting together around coffee and beer and other drinks. And I don't want to say always fomenting revolution, but that's part of what they were doing, I would imagine. Give us a sense of sort of the social scene around food at the time.
Yeah, I mean, those were the places where community came together around food in a public way, taverns and coffee houses, and both of them would serve food along with it, even though that's not in the way that maybe we think about it superficially. But yes, the taverns were places where you could have meetings, do business. You even picked up your mail at a tavern. There were even coffee houses that served alcoholic beverages in the evening. And, you know, it's kind of these places that were the third sphere where you're meeting and getting together with friends. And then, of course, you have your dinner parties at homes and these kinds of things. But there was a lot of available space for gathering and meeting and finding the energy to maybe have a revolution.
You know, like all, like we're talking coffee, tea, things like that, they were all boiled the water. Even chocolate drinks were pretty, like hot chocolate, and if they would let it cool, that's how you were able to mix the chocolate, by making it hot. So that was a big, big drink that would compete with beer in a sense.
For folks that don't know, Tegan, you know a lot about bones.
And
in
trash,
a good way,
too.
In a good way, yeah.
And they're trash. All animal bones, though.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your work and how your work helps us kind of establish our field of knowledge about what people were eating, drinking, throwing away. I'm just so curious, like, this is still happening today.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Down by the Delaware Excavating River, people are right finding now. Bones and drawing conclusions from those bones. I would just love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so I, for the last 15 years, have been working on the I-95 project right here in Philadelphia. And because they're going to be expanding the federal highway, there's a federal mandate that they do archaeological excavation to make sure that they're not destroying cultural resources in the building of that highway. So all the bones that they dig up out of the ground there, they send to me in my lab at the Penn Museum. And I analyze all the animal bones, and I then get to write reports. So what I hopefully by the end of this project will be able to do is compare and contrast different areas of the city at different time periods. We have as much detail as like who's living in a household at a particular time and place, what kinds of industries were going on, what kinds of businesses. And so we'll be able to have a much broader perspective of the food of Philadelphia, how it varied across space, time, ethnicity, race, all of these things, in so many interesting ways. And what I love about the kind of archaeology that I do, which is this historic period, is I then get to take what I find in the bones and compare it to what's written. In that space, there is often a gap, a disagreement, a question.
Ooh, can you give us an example? Ooh. Is there one that springs to mind? Like, I'm just like, this is the forensic part of it,
yes.
That's so interesting. Like, you're digging around, you find something, you compare it to the historical record, and just you go like, I would imagine like, okay.
Yeah.
That's
well,
right.
a couple of things come to mind. Like, for example, in the realm of turtle soup.
We're back to the turtles. Good.
They never talk about snapping turtles. Like almost never in the historical record. But we have, that's the most common archaeologically.
Hmm. So then of course, then you're wondering why.
Yeah. You're like, what? Why don't you agree? So Fishtown is named Fishtown because it's the place where fishermen lived with their families. It was close to the docks, and they could help offload the fish. They could also process the fish at the waterfront, and so on. So one might assume that there'd be a lot of fish bones in the deposits in Fishtown. And this turns out to not be the case. That in fact, there are fewer fish bones in Fishtown than there are in other parts of Philadelphia.
Hmm.
So then as an archaeologist, you have to say, well, why is that happening? And one reason may be that because these are fishermen, they are actually processing the fish that they then take home to their families at the locations of where they are fishing. And so they're bringing home the fillets, whereas other people are purchasing the fish in the marketplace, taking them home and processing them there. It's just these kinds of like little, that is really fascinating. Not to mention, you know, you pick up a sturgeon bone in the lab, which is one of the coolest looking fish bones. If you've never seen one, you need to look it up. And
Google
and then,
sturgeon bones.
Yeah,
okay.
Sturgeon scutes. And there are so many amazing stories about sturgeon in the newspapers of Philadelphia in the 18th century. Like, you would not believe how many stories about huge sturgeon, 500 pounds, you know, taking policemen who are trying to capture them and like dragging them through the water mill and all of this stuff. And so
it was almost like big game hunting or something like
big
that.
Fish.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, so something that's just a bone today becomes this elaborate story that's like so much more fun and interesting. And you get to combine them to have this deeper understanding of food in the past.
You know what? You lit up talking about
that
sturgeon.
I love this stuff. So, I love it.
A crazy thing about sturgeon, they used to keep beer in the swim bladder of a cold water sturgeon. And they would bring it like across the ocean and ships and things like that. And then when they got to their destination, they would find the beer was crystal clear, all because of the swim bladder of the sturgeon. Yeah.
Wait, break this down.
Rewind.
So rewind. They had found that, and what we use something in beer called finings. It's like a negatively charged particles that attract the positively charged yeast and proteins that will make it settle quicker and make the beer totally bright and clean. And it was, you know, when you brought up sturgeon, I just said, they really don't do that much of it anymore because we have good filtration now. But that's what they used to do to make the beer crystal clear and bright.
I just wanted to quickly ask you, Tegan, just sort of the differences in class. If you were like a skilled laborer versus a craft artisan versus a landowner, was your table different?
Yeah, I mean, there's differences by degree. Right. So if you had lots of money, you could afford to have more variety in your diet. You could afford to pay for better quality cuts of meat. You could buy more meat. You could get more wild animals in your diet. You probably, if you were a gentleman, might have had a gentleman farm outside of the city, which would give you more ready access to that. If you were less wealthy, you would purchase cheaper cuts of meat, you would eat it less often, you would supplement with more starches and vegetables. Then, of course, there was the different cultural traditions that would play into that, as well as your neighborhood and what you had access to in terms of the markets and the other purveyors that would give you the food.
So variety and access to good cuts of meat, that was the difference between.
And, you know, what you did for a living. If you were a butcher, you probably could still get some good meat.
Facts, that part, yeah.
Well, Tegan and Tom, thank you so much.
You guys are great.
For enlightening us today.
Oh, what a great conversation. Yeah. It takes me back. I'm also a little bit hungry now, Cherry. Maybe we will grab a snack or something during this quick break.
Yeah, let's do it. And when we come back, we're spotlighting the Battle of Brandywine. Stay tuned for more of this special edition of Studio 2 right here on WHYY.
Beautiful, far heroes proved.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This is a special edition of our show in celebration of Independence Day tomorrow, America's big 250th birthday. We're listening to some of our conversations we've had on Studio 2 over the last year. Many of them were on the road, before a live audience at old taverns and historic buildings across the region.
We recently traveled to Chad's Ford, home of Brandywine Battlefield Park. George Washington slept there, his infantry's headquarters were on the grounds, and just beyond the park, the largest single-day battle of the American Revolution raged.
And it was not a small cast of characters. Lafayette was there and wounded there. Alexander Hamilton was there. Hessian troops, loyalists, patriots, Quaker families, farmers, civilians, and so many others all caught in the path of war.
And here's the twist. Brandywine was an American defeat, but defeat is not the whole story because Washington's army survived. The revolution continued. And for the people that lived here, the battle didn't end just because the gunshots stopped.
To talk about what really happened, we sat down with two guests at Brandywine Battlefield Park Visitor Center. Sarah Mash is the 250th Strategic Events Coordinator for the park, and Ben Olex is the museum educator. We started by asking what was happening on and off the battlefield in the buildup to this pivotal event.
Washington came to the area sometime on September 9th, so we already have American troops kind of picking their place to stay September 9th, 2 days before the battle. We see this anticipation building, camps going up. A lot of families, when they heard about the war coming towards them, they sent children away. They sent indentured servants and enslaved workers away for fear that the British would, you know, conscript those items from them, those people from them. So anxiety had been building 2 days before this. By the time the battle came, people kind of had a plan of where to go and what to do.
Yeah, and the reaction of people is different depending on where you live and I guess what's going on in the community, certainly. So we know from the British reports as they are coming through Delaware, they note that the towns and cities they're going through are absolutely deserted. Like the people heard the British were coming and they ran into the hills to get away. You know, they're going to bury all their silverware and all that sort of stuff and try to take what they can with them. But you have other places, for example, there are a lot of stories here of the Quakers who, you know, they're not going to be participating in the war, so they're almost like pretending it's not happening. So they're in the Quaker meeting, you know, praying, talking to each other, all that sort of stuff, like while the battle's going on, while the army is marching by outside. Hard choice. I wouldn't want to make it.
Yeah, tough. Yeah. And so one of the things that fascinated me about the Battle of Brandywine is that this was a magnet for the who's who of the Revolutionary War. You had all the big names come here. And can you sort of set the scene? Why was this the place that you have Marquis de Lafayette, Alexander Hamilton here, you have George Washington, you have all the big names that we all know and recite. How did that come to be? And then, of course, I'll have a follow-up for you on that one.
Sure. I mean, the army that's operating here, this is the main Continental Army. So George Washington's going to follow them around. There are several different departments in the Continental Army. There's a Northern Army that's opposing Burgoyne up near Canada. But this is kind of like the all-star group here. So this is where you have the most men, kind of the most concentration. And Washington knows that this is a big fight that he's going to have. So he's pulling soldiers from up north to come join his army because he's, again, concerned that he's going to need as many men as possible. So, yeah, absolutely. You have Washington's here. Lafayette's kind of here by chance just because he happens to arrive at the correct time. He has been given a Major General's Commission, which is the highest one you can get. And Hamilton is serving as Washington's aide-de-camp, which is a really crucial thing. These are the guys who are writing all of Washington's, like literally writing all of Washington's orders. They're communicating all of that information to different generals. It's a really, really crucial job. And we have a few records of them here at the Battle of Brandywine and kind of what they were doing, which is very exciting.
And we mentioned about 30,000 troops in all. And what's about 17,000, 18,000 British? Is that about right?
Yeah, and you know, with these estimates, it's always a little bit of a guess, sure. But somewhere around 17,000.
So slight majority mm-hmm. British. So out the Americans are outnumbered militarily. Before all this starts, what is the goal? And when you know you have you know fewer troops, what exactly are they trying to do? Just discourage them? They feel like they can totally stop them. What are they attempting?
Probably defend them off. I think they know that the chances of just outright defeating the British Army are somewhat low. So if we go down to the ford, some people don't know what a ford is. A ford is a shallow part in the river where you would literally walk through the river. And that's really a bottleneck. So when your army is marching through, I mean, they have to all kind of clump together, come out the other side, and then wait for all the other guys behind them. If you're Washington on this side and the British Army is kind of accordioning through, that's a really great way to shoot at them. And you have probably a better chance of winning the battle that way. So whether it be just to kind of stave them off, this is September, so usually campaigning in the 18th century ends sometime at the end of November, maybe the beginning of December, maybe just to hold them off until that point. But if you can clinch sort of this decisive victory using the topography of the area to your advantage, that would be great.
Now, Sarah, let me ask you this, because Ben mentioned that, you know, there were a lot of loyalists who were helping the British, and in our minds today, we're thinking, Wait a second. This is the colonies. Why isn't everyone helping Washington? Explain how that dynamic could possibly be playing out here.
First of all, war and the Red Coat, it's a big spectacle, right? So I feel like for a lot of people living in the area, if they don't feel like choosing a side, but they want some sort of involvement. So we know Joseph Townsend was a Quaker in the area. He has the most detailed civilian account of the battle. He followed the British along the entire time, kind of whispering a few things, guiding them along the route, mostly just hanging out with his friends saying, oh, look at us in a battle right now. So I think for a lot of people that, you know, were conflicted with their own morals and obligations, it was just something fun to be a part of, like a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing, which, you know, I feel like that's a very human response.
Mm-hmm. So they're sliding a little paperwork, slide a little bit of intelligence to whatever their chosen side. Maybe. And so I understand this battle took 11 hours. very bloody. So tell us how it sort of kicks off. All the soldiers are converging. Walk us through it.
The British have a plan. Obviously, they have this intelligence that Washington, that there's a route around Washington's army. So Howe splits his army, not exactly in two, but in two. And he and General Cornwallis are going to take some of the soldiers, really the best in his army, and they're going to be the ones who are doing the flank march around Washington. And General Knyphausen, with the rest of the army, are just coming right down the Great Post Road right here. So they're coming right down Route 1 from Longwood Gardens. Their job is to just distract Washington, say, oh, we're going to come get you. And Washington is sitting on this side of the river, kind of watching this going on, and he thinks, oh, well, this is the army over here, so I need to be prepared for this. So, I mean, it does take so long because that march that the British took to get around Washington was, depending on what you're reading, somewhere between 15 and 17 miles. And so it takes them hours to do that. And it's, I mean, the weather that day, it started off very foggy. It was cloudy, a little bit cooler. But by midday, it's probably about 90 degrees. And you know, everyone's wearing their wool uniforms, of course. And one of the British soldiers, after they'd completed the flank march, they got across the fords. Washington still had not figured out where they were. One of them just drops dead. Because it had been just such an exhausting march. Now, Washington does not realize what has happened to him until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on that day. So he was eating his dinner, and colonial people ate their dinner in the middle of the day as opposed to at the end. And that is when he got word some of his scouts had been up north of where we are at a place called Birmingham Hill, and they had seen General Howe's army up on Osborne Hill, which is kind of a little bit to the north of that. And so they had seen him kind of crowding around on the hill, and they say, oh, no. And that is when he sends reinforcements down from the ford here up to Birmingham Hill, and that is really where the main kind of pitched battle occurs here at the Battle of Brandywine.
So I don't know what the colonial equivalent is of oh, bleep, but at some point, right, Washington is coming to this realization. Mm-hmm. They confront. What happens then?
So Washington has two divisions, and there's no standardized kind of number of men that would be. We can say maybe about 15,000. He sends two of them up to Birmingham Hill, which again is about 2.5 miles north of where we are right now. And he then sends a third. And this poor guy, General Sullivan, and he's fought in many battles throughout the American Revolution and continues to do so. He was tasked with guarding all of the fords up the river. Now, what I didn't mention is that the two fords that the British used were actually the only two that were unguarded. So either he didn't know they were there or he thought they were too far from the British to use them. But he also sends General Sullivan up to Birmingham Hill as well. And so what you have is sort of, if you can imagine Birmingham Hill and Osborne Hill, these two hills opposing each other, there's kind of like a valley almost in between. But the terrain is so undulating. And if you get a chance to go up there, I encourage everyone to do so. It's these great sort of magnificent rolling hills all around throughout the area, but also with some dense areas of wood. So the Americans get up on that hill. They're preparing themselves, and the British come down off of Osborne Hill to begin their attack, and they're going to attack all at once. So there's no sort of attempt at another flanking maneuver or anything like that. The whole army is just going to come at the Americans.
So we gave the sort of the setup for the battle, and the battle begins in earnest. The Americans are outmaneuvered, outnumbered, but it could have gone worse. Explain that.
Well, it can always go worse. So what happens here is that General Sullivan, unfortunately, his division is not able to get into line exactly as they would have wanted. As they are trying to maneuver into position, the British kind of come out of the woods, see them, and they're like, oh, this is great. And so they shoot at them and then charge them, and his whole division is kind of wiped away. Mm-hmm. So you have now, if you are General Sterling, who again is in the middle of the American line, you're being attacked from the front by these grenadiers who are charging at you, and then you're being attacked from the side as well. This sounds really disastrous, but a lot of people who are leaving this battle, you have Washington, you have some of the officers who are participating in it, and they'll write about this battle, and they'll say, we actually stood up there for a long time. And this is really the key thing. This is the way that if Washington wants to win this battle, he needs an army that is going to stay there when the British run at them. And so this is the kind of beginning of how Washington is going to be able to keep that army together. And then by the end of the war, the American Continental Army is going to be on par with basically any army that you have in Europe.
Is this spin to Congress or is this real? Like it's actually an impressive performance by the Americans.
I'll be honest. I don't know. I think a little bit of it is that, I mean, I don't know how you come away from a lost battle where you are, you know, fleeing for your life and think, wow, that went really well. There's an element of that, I think, to be sure. And Washington, when he's writing back to Congress, is, you know, he's saying hey, we stood up to them and that was good. And he says, the men, he says, myself, and the men are raring for another fight. Mm. And that is true. I mean, Washington is going to try to put his men in another fight as quickly as possible. It doesn't actually end up working out that way. But he's going to try to do so. Whether the men all were on board with that, I'm sure a lot of them were pretty upset at how that worked out.
They also get away, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of like a theme of the early part of this conflict is Americans lose, but they get away.
Yes.
They survive.
They survive.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so how do they survive? How do they avoid sort of like a more catastrophic defeat here?
So in 18th century warfare, it's very hard to actually like catch the people that you're trying to engage with. So if you are getting into a battle, it's most likely because someone on the other side made a mistake and you were chasing them, or they wanted you to catch them. So Washington is just able to keep his army as mobile as possible and keep it out of the reach of the British army for as long as he can. And then once he waits it out long enough, you get to December, and by that point, the British have to go into winter quarters, as does he. And, you know, it should be mentioned, this has to be done because the roads turn to rivers of mud. This is not just because people, you know, were like weaker back then and couldn't stand being outside in the cold. They had to stop. They wouldn't be able to move things around as much. So Washington's going to go off to Valley Forge to live to fight another day.
Yeah. I want to zoom in a little bit because you both talked about how, you know, this was a loss and they had to flee. And I just wonder, was there like a turning point? Was there like a moment when Washington was like, you know what, we're beat. We have no other choice. Our butts have been kicked. And if we want to live to see another day, which, you know, he did, we must retreat. What moment was that?
Well, the army makes the decision for him, I think, in a large part. So he's down here by the ford until probably somewhere around 5 o'clock or so. And we have a letter from his secretary who was writing to Congress, kind of like, you know, like live tweeting almost what's happening at the battle, sending these back. And obviously there's not that many of them. But they have one around 5 o'clock and it still exists. You can read it. He is telling Congress, hey, Congress, there's a body of the enemy that's flanked us, but we don't know like exactly where they came from. We don't know how many there are. It's probably not that many. Some people say it's like 2,000. Again, it's 9,000 men that have flanked him. So this is information. Washington does not know exactly what's happened to him, even at 5 o'clock. Now, he eventually makes the decision to ride up there. And so he goes up there and he arrives near what's called the 1704 house, which is kind of a local landmark, which is about, I would say, maybe about a mile and a half, 2 miles from where we are now. And he's on the lawn there, and he sees his army kind of streaming away in defeat. And that's a pretty clear symbol to him that this is not going well anymore. So that is probably the moment that he realizes this is not going to be a winner.
That was our conversation in Chad's Ford with Ben Olex, museum educator at Brandywine Battlefield Park, and Sarah Mash, the park's 250th strategic events coordinator.
Coming up next, we're taking a closer look at the Revolution's marginalized groups, what independence meant to them, and how they fought for freedom. We'll be right back with more of this special edition of Studio 2.
Above me, that in the sky way, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to this special edition of Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The founding fathers, the speeches, the battles, and the documents that shaped the nation. With just a day to go until the big 250, these stories, names, and faces are everywhere. But there's also important history to be told about the people who were fighting for freedom, while also being denied freedom themselves.
A new documentary explores history through the lens of communities of color right here in Philadelphia. It begins with the arrival of the Isabella, the first ship carrying enslaved Africans to the Port of Philadelphia's Old London Coffee House. The filmmakers take us to the Arch Street Meeting House, where Quakers debated abolition, and Mother Bethel AME, a church founded by a freed black man.
Philly is not just the birthplace of American democracy. It's a city where people pushed back against the laws and systems that marginalized and dehumanized them. It was also home to the largest free and literate group of black people in the entire British Empire.
The film we're talking about is called Becoming American, Philadelphia Story, and it dives into all of this, all of the pain and struggle, the community and connection. It was the idea of Oliver St. Clair Franklin, and he brought it to life with co-executive producer Annie Connolly. The project truly was Oliver's conception, decades in the making. He moved here in the 70s when America was celebrating an earlier birthday.
I had just arrived in Philadelphia for the bicentennial, and I was rather excited about it until I realized that most African Americans didn't emotionally connect with the bicentennial. And I decided that if I was around in 50 years for, you know, our semi-quincentennial, our 250th, I'd try to do something to address that gap. I didn't know what it was. And then I was in a film with Oxford University about the slave trade, and I met Annie and her team. And as I saw them work, I knew, aha, I can make a film.
Philadelphia, a vibrant cultural center, a modern high-rise glass metropolis, with 2.5 centuries of American stories around every corner.
I wanted to make a film about the black community in Philadelphia during the founding era. I wanted it to be historically correct. I wanted it to be visually stunning and beautiful. And I love the fact that they were British. So it's a double entendre of having a British do a film for our 250th, which was a big laugh amongst us. But the fact that they were British, they brought an outsider's view to their perspective.
I want to sort of go to, you know, your thought process, because a lot of people, when they tell stories about the founding of America, it's based in this mythology, right? That, you know, these people came together. They had these ideals about democracy, about freedom, and you wanted to push past that. Can you talk about that intention?
And the reason we could do it is because 50 years ago, the scholarship wasn't there. What we do is the scholars are really uncovering this history.
Yeah.
They're writing beautiful works. But when they finish their book and go on their book tour, the next question is, what are you doing next? They move on. Our job was to take what the scholars have done and make it visual.
Yeah.
To really tell it to the people. And what you're able to do is close this gap. You see, if you don't know, you can't remember. And if you can't remember, you have no history. And so our job was to tell people, African Americans, but all people, these people were real. They had real lives. They had battles they fought. They pulled together. They existed. They survived. They had joy, right? And we wanted to bring the human dimension to this group of people from the 1790s. And in doing that, bring it to a level that a person with a PhD and a person with a GED
could understand,
process, and really appreciate.
And so I want to get to some of the facts, because one of the starting points of the film was with the arrival of black people as enslaved individuals. The first slave ship, Oliver, the Isabella, arrived in Philadelphia. Tell us a bit of that story, 1684.
Well, the ship came up from the west coast of Africa, dropped people off in Jamaica, and was working its way to the docks of Philadelphia. We're not certain exactly where most came from, but we think most of the people came from what would be present-day Ghana, along the coast, along Senegal. And what the team has done, which I think brilliantly, is give you a feeling for the horror of people leaving that ship. And what our paper artist did, which I think was really interesting, and we sort of go into it, she gets the negative space of the first person stepping off the ship before they land. Before that foot comes down in America, it's about 4 inches. We call that the negative space. So we try to capture that, because once she lands, it's over in many ways for that enslaved person.
You can imagine a woman who has their young child.
They're up on the sail block. There's shouting back and forth. She doesn't understand what's going on. And then someone comes up and takes her baby. And it's like,
what's going on?
What's going on? Am I going to see that baby? Am I going to see my child?
Yeah.
In a couple of minutes or, you know.
Or ever.
Yeah, or ever.
They went to 2nd and Market Street. You'll see in the film that the building is still there.
Yeah, it's a coffee shop.
It's a coffee shop.
I want you to try to describe to people who haven't yet seen the film sort of what life was like, Oliver, for enslaved people in Philadelphia at that time, before Philadelphia, I guess, became Philadelphia.
Yeah. I think the first thing that surprised me was how closely people lived together. You know, I grew up in a segregated society. I didn't see white people. I thought we were all separated. But in a city like Philadelphia, where everything was so close together, you have free people, you have people who would be called undocumented today, who are out from slavery trying to work their way north. You have Irish immigrants, you have Spanish, you have indigenous people.
Chinese sailors.
Chinese sailors. Mm-hmm. And they're all living together. And that was a revelation for me because I still had the vision that we were all sort of like South Carolina or Virginia, mm-hmm. where I'm from.
Yeah.
Blacks and whites, we lived in the farm, they lived in the house. So everything was so cosmopolitan. And what happened is when you have all this closeness, black people are hearing everything. They're hearing stories about freedom. They're hearing stories about independence. They're hearing stories about battles.
They were ripped away from their families, yes. They were kidnapped. They were trafficked across the Atlantic Ocean. But they were resilient and made the best of the situation that they found themselves in.
10% of all sailors were black. They were called blackjacks. So they were the network connecting all these black communities because they'd go to Jamaica and they'd get stuff. When they arrived in Philadelphia, they'd go right down to Mother Bethel in that community and people would say, what's happening? And they would share this information. So what we are trying to portray is the high level of interaction and communication that came together that inform these black folks that they should fight for the same rights of citizenship as white people were getting in this country. Those of us studying early America, most of us, at least I was very shocked because most of the writing where black people were sermons. And I came up in the 60s. We didn't want to read sermons. Mm-hmm. We wanted to read, you know, political tracts. And Tara Bynum, who is one of the scholars, has gone through these sermons and actually translated what they really meant from the time they were in, thee and thou, and it's difficult to read.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All
just
right,
because
for
of
us.
The language differences.
Language
yeah.
difference. She went in it, an expert in the language, and then she began to extract what the real meaning was underneath of this language. They used a lot of stories from the Old Testament
yeah.
to talk about freedom. But they had to couch it in very thankful ways because all the printers were white. A printer would read something and say, I'm not going to print that.
You know, there were so many moments, I think, that stood out to me. And one that I think set the foundation for today was the rise of the Black church. As, you know, a place of empowerment for black people, also political power for black people. You know, Annie, if you could talk about that a little bit, because we actually have a historic relic right here with Mother Bethel AME Church.
I mean, I haven't answered your question earlier fully where you said, what did I learn? Well, one of the things was so we did lots of brilliant things like Chris's Jazz Club and listening to music that was rearranged and played from Francis Johnson, the Adunde, loved that. But actually, the Mother Bethel service that we were invited in to film, it wasn't set up, it was their Sunday service. I'm from a Church of England background, you know, which is not as strict as Catholic, but it's very much, you know, stand, kneel, sing, you know, do what you're told. It's reflective, it's quiet, it's contemplative, but it's a sort of more traditional, quiet church setting in England. And I went into that church. I loved it. There was so much energy. It was vibrant. It was brilliant. I mean, the light that shone through those windows, and I love stained glass windows, but the history of that site, which we had researched, which we'd looked in the archives at, Reverend Carolyn Caverness was enormously welcoming. The whole congregation just let our crew in, and we were wandering everywhere. But what I loved about it was this, and you get that sense today still, this sense of serving God and a community and faith, but that is a deep-rooted faith in that place.
There's nowhere a place on earth like Mother Bethel. Sits on the oldest parcel of land continuously owned by African Americans, just not in Philadelphia, but in the whole United States of America.
That place is special. But what I loved about it was that it was such a different, as a black church, was a different experience for me that I've ever had. And I was like, wow, why aren't my services like this? They're so much more fun. They're so much more vibrant. The singing is so, everyone's up, everyone's dancing, everyone's laughing. And it was wild, and I loved it. Yeah. And you were sort of on this wave. And I wonder if that, when we think about the early black churches, it would have been there. And Reverend Carolyn Caverness said to us in her interview, Monday to Saturday, this was not their reality. And here they could be themselves. So it was for education. It was for politicking. It was for making, I'm sure there was business conversations going on. I'm sure there was family. I'm sure there was sadness, celebration, joy, people yeah. falling in love, you know, whatever, children running around. And I think that to be in a space where no one else saw you must have been yeah. incredible and against the grain of what else was happening in the country.
As we get ready to end, the title Becoming American, I mean, what are you hoping that people take from hearing all these distinct stories about black participation, black resistance, and the black quest for freedom, right? And black joy, right? Because all of that is sort of mixed in here. What conversations do you hope that the community has around the 250?
I'm surprised by how contemporary the film is today. Who is an American? Who belongs in America? I'm also surprised that the retrenchment in civil rights in America today, that this group was a group where everything was against them. They didn't have laws protecting it. And yet they survived. They created. They stuck together.
And you're talking about black people in Philadelphia.
Black people.
Yeah.
They were self-reliant. And what the present moment says with the retrenchment of civil rights is that we've got to start getting that mindset back of self-reliance, depending on each other, yeah. trusting and loving each other more.
Becoming American is available to stream for free on demand on the WHYY Watch app and the PBS app. It will air on WHYY World Channel tonight at 9 or catch another broadcast on TV12 this Sunday at 6 p.m.
This special edition of our show was produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineers on location and at WHYY for Tavern Revolution 250 include Tina Calique, Paul Parmalee, Theron Lewis, Ben Call, Dan Rosenthal, Gary Lindstrom, Mike Schiffler, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. Our technical director was Julian Hertzfeld.
Studio 2's executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In America, happy birthday.
We gon' celebrate. Party with you, come on now.
Celebration.
Let's all celebrate and have a good time.